This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. My name is Doug Webb, and I'm the coordinator for today's event. And we're very fortunate today to have Eric Gartzi. He's a associate professor at the Political Science Building. Actually, he's just right up the hill up here is where his offices are. Let me tell you a little something about him. He received his PhD from the University of Iowa in 1997, and he has written on the effects of global commerce, economic development, system structure, and climate change on war. His research has been published in numerous academic journals, so we're very pleased to have him today. Mr. Gartzi, Professor.
Thank you. Well, thank you all for coming out today. I really appreciate it. This is tremendous and very exciting for me. One thing I'd like to say before I get started is I've been thinking a lot lately about the nature of the advocacy of ideas. And one of the problems we have as a larger intellectual community is sometimes ideas are just compelling in their own right. And sometimes it helps to have a really good advocate for those ideas. Some of you will remember the O.J. Simpson case in which O.J. got off on what looked like a fairly substantial amount of circumstantial evidence. And he appeared to have benefited from the advocacy which he was able to obtain. Okay, the average suspect isn't going to get world-class advocates. And I worry about this for ideas sometimes, is because academia in particular is trendy, and certain things are popular and cool and neat, and other things are not, that the advocacy of ideas, is the sort of pitch factor, is always going to be an important component of the success or failure of a particular theory or idea. And so this poor advocate is going to present to you what I think is a better idea than the advocate. And I hope the idea comes through despite my lack of pithy comments and wisdom and expertise. We won't have a moment where the glove doesn't fit. So let's talk about these things a little bit. Here's just a quick outline, and this is the other thing that shows poor advocacy is I've been starting to do some work in Washington more, and the typical Washington presentation has lots of beautiful pictures, right? And you sort of kind of you the PowerPoint euphoria happens, and people start gliding off into this warm fuzzy feeling without really understanding the ideas, and academics traditionally have opposed that a little bit, but we're starting to succumb to, and you'll see a little bit of a mix of these two things. So I want to talk about kind of the nature of the world in a very abstract way, and the reason I want to do that is I want to set our times and in the recent past and hopefully, potentially, the future in a kind of framework that makes sense to people, or at least a framework that they can disagree with. Right, I think one of the pathologies that we run into as a society is current event myopia. Okay, we all pay attention to the news, but the news is designed to be exciting and visceral, and the temptation is to react to things that get our attention rather than seeing sort of a bigger picture. And I want to move back to that bigger picture because I think, in fact, one of the real problems that U.S. foreign policy in particular has suffered from is this tendency to react and not have a big picture, what is sometimes called grand strategy. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about these two questions. What causes peace? What causes the absence of warfare? And how do we kind of sustain it or maintain it? And we're very fortunate in our lifetimes, or at least in my lifetime, and for some of you, your lifetimes are at least part of it, to have experienced an extraordinary era of peace. We actually have seen stuff get better in the world. And we want to understand, I think, why that happens so that we can sustain it. Because it's potentially the case that there's some challengers out there, some threats, some factors that will make it a little bit more difficult moving forward. Okay. So the world is a violent place, and I want to make that clear. I'm not arguing that the world isn't violent. I'm not arguing that people aren't suffering and dying throughout the world. Obviously they are. Okay? And you can kind of, everybody has their own list, but we could kind of go and tick off many places where the politics or the logic of violence, governance through the gun, is the modal behavior. Okay? And also, one thing to think about, and I think this is not new on my part, this is something that many other people have started to notice, is that the patterns that we see in terms of where things are violent and where they're not violent looks a lot like the turn of the last century, late 19th century, early 20th century, where things are pretty good in some places, in a lot of places, and they're pretty bad in others. And the places where they're good and the places where they're bad sort of line up. So we want to think about that too. Basically, as in many other spheres of human endeavor, there's a first world and a second world, right? There's a portion of the planet which is pretty nice to live in, and there's a portion of the planet which is pretty awful to live in. And in fact, this is an ongoing problem. We're concerned about immigration. Europeans now, today, are especially concerned about immigration. There are portions of Asia that are also concerned about immigration. This is basically an attempt of people who are living in those not-so-nice places, you know, to move to places where they can live a better life. Okay. So developed countries are engaged in conflict. The global north does experience conflict, but it's typically somewhere else, and it's typically at their choosing. And that's a luxury, to be able to choose when and where you want to expend the treasure and blood of your civilization, and when you're not interested, is an opportunity that historically even very powerful countries haven't always had. Okay, there is a caveat here, terrorism, but that goes back to my pitch that we get myopic. Terrorism is really important. I don't want to undermine or discount the threat that terrorism poses, but I think that it's easy to exaggerate it. And in fact, the strategy of terror is predicated on the hope, the assumption that people will exaggerate it. Right? When terrorists attack, they're attacking not out of strength, but out of weakness. They're using a kind of strategy that's designed to get their targets to exaggerate the threat. And so the very act of terrorism itself is indicative of the fact that you're dealing with relatively weak actors, relatively marginal actors that aren't going to chart the course of history. What they're doing is trying to slow it down, right? Prevent it from happening. And they can only succeed when we help them, when we participate in that, by watching the evening news and exaggerating the nature of the threat. Yes, something needs to be done about terrorism, but it doesn't mean that we have to reorient our grand strategy, our entire focus, our efforts, any more than, for example, we live in a I'm going to make this case, we live in a peaceful world. We live in a peaceful country, but there's crime out there, right? And we all take reasonable precautions to deal with that crime. But most of us, reasonably, don't let it dominate our lives. Don't let it become the objective of our life as opposed to something that we're trying to avoid and prevent and minimize. Okay. So the point is that while there is lots of violence in the world today, it's occurring in some places, mostly in marginal parts of the world, and less so than in the past. And the sort of core parts of the world civilization, the parts that used to be the most violent because they had the most resources to fight each other, these are becoming much less violent. Okay. So what evidence do we have that peace is possible? One of the risks in talking about peace is that it's got a bad rap, right? Advocates for peace have tended to emphasize more the savory nature, the appeal of peace, rather than sort of a hard nosed look at what, in fact, what mechanisms exist that could make the world more stable, more peaceful. And of course, so one of the things I want to do today is emphasize that this is not aspirational. I want peace as much as anybody else, but I'm not selling a picture of the world that I don't think is practical. I'm selling a picture of the world that I think actually exists and one that we can promote, emphasize, and improve. Okay, so the truth of the matter is that war itself is very unusual. Okay, we gravitate to it. We get a lot of our attention is drawn to it. We watch news media. We look on the internet. We read blogs. And because if it bleeds, it leads is a truism about journalism. We're drawn to, and we come to expect that conflict is the modal human behavior. Okay, I have a family. I have three kids and a wife, and it does seem like we argue a lot. Okay, I'm sure nobody else has experienced this before, but sometimes children want different things than their parents. But the truth of the matter is, we spend relatively a small portion of our day arguing. It's just that that's the thing that we are drawn to, that we remember, that we focus on, because it's more visceral. It's more it's more memorable. It's more, it has more exciting content. Okay, the boring stuff. Peace itself is pretty boring. And to go on the evening news every night and or watch the evening news every night and have somebody tell you, well, nothing happened today, right? Everything was fine. You didn't get hurt, okay? Nobody attacked you. Nobody mugged you. Nobody stole anything. That's not going to get you to watch that show again, right? So you want to see these things because they have a visceral entertainment value. That's human nature. That's the DNA we're built with. But the truth of the matter is, war itself is episodic. It's rare. It tends to happen and end. And the reason is that it's very costly, even for the actors that want to do it. Right? You expend enormous resources. The U.S. in Iraq over the last decade and a half spent something like $2 trillion. Okay. Now there's a debate. You can go to the war economists, and they will debate. Well, it's $3 trillion. No, it's $1 trillion. What? I'm just giving you a number that'll stick in your head, and that's good enough, right? It's huge. Okay. War is very, very, very expensive, even if successful. And obviously, if you're not successful in war, it's even more expensive. Okay, unless you happen to fight the United States, in which case we build you nice stuff and you live happily ever after. No, but this is in itself an indication that the nature of conflict is not the modal behavior, that we're spending a lot of time even in those zones that we think of as conflict prone. Human beings at an individual level, at a social level, at a national level, are spending most of their time not fighting. And they depart from that in order to prosecute some objectives. And then they go back to it again, because fighting takes you away from productive endeavors. You can't be on the farm if you're shooting at somebody. You can't raise your kids if you're away from home on some kind of mission or something like that. Okay. So, peace, especially in its negative form, and I'm going to explain later what negative and positive peace look like, but basically, most of the time, countries, groups, and individuals spend most of their time not fighting each other. So we already have lots and lots and lots of peace. We just want to take it kind of to the end zone and finish this off. We want to get to the point where it's not mostly peace, but hopefully always peace. Okay. So one of the sort of unfortunate things that happened in my career is, this is selfish on my part, but my family and I moved to, I got a job teaching at Columbia University in New York. And this was very exciting. And we moved to New York, and we moved in August of 2001, right? And then the next month, 9/11 happened. And it clearly reoriented everyone's agenda, scholars included. At the time, I had been preparing an outline for what is, in effect, this project, which is a theory of peace. And there was no interest in this, right? I saw immediately that I couldn't sell this to anyone. I'd have to spend a lot of time up front convincing people inside and outside of academia that this wasn't a ridiculous thing even to discuss. Okay? So time has passed, and I basically put this on a shelf. So time has passed. This is one of the realities of an academic life, is the first 6 years of your career are incredibly focused and myopic. Some of you, as academics, will know that tenure is this sort of concentrating effect, you know, the Hobbesian argument about the prospect of being hanged and so on. So you don't do the big projects that maybe would be more fulfilling and more useful to society. You do the little things that you think you can get done quickly in order to make sure that you get tenure and so on. All right. So, but in the meantime, there have been a flurry of projects that have done a lot of nice stuff. They've made the case for me and others that actually empirically that this trend towards peace exists. Okay, so the first part of this argument is out there, and it can be used by others. The second part of the argument is where I'm going to focus today, and it's a little bit harder, and that's explaining why this trend has occurred. So I'm going to explain this trend a bit more. Basically, we have lots of evidence now that the world is becoming more peaceful, at least parts of it, and this is over a very long period of history. Okay. But two things this literature doesn't do, and I'm going to kind of go back and forth with this in the presentation. The first thing it doesn't do is explain very well why it is that the world's parts of the world are becoming more peaceful. And the second it doesn't do, and this is tied to the first, is it doesn't tell us how to keep it. Right? Good news. The police statistics say that crime rate is going down. They are. However, we don't know why it's going down, and not knowing why it's going down, we're not able to affect good policy to make it go down faster or more or keep it down. So the same thing is an issue at the international level. The good news is the United States has been largely able to either be at peace or pick the wars it wanted to fight for the past 60 years. The bad news is we have no idea why we succeeded. We don't. We have guesses, speculations about why it is that this peace was sustained since the end of the Second World War. But for the most part, these guesses are not very well substantiated empirically. We don't have good, strong theories about this success. And that's kind of what got me going in this literature. Okay. By the way, these pictures up here... the first is in the Spratlys, and the Chinese are building islands because I have my own ideas about why, but it's not clear why you would want to build an island. There are a lot of islands in the world. Well, it just so happens that these islands are in a particular place that's useful to China. And the picture on the right is of the Senkaku Daiyu island chain, which is, you know, tiny. And again, it's not clear why countries want these places. But it's an indication of the fraying around the edges of this peace and stability, which the Northern Hemisphere has benefited from. And we can come up with lots of examples. I don't have any pictures of the Crimean or Ukraine here, but the same sort of problem, that this peace and stability that we've benefited from maybe weakening, and whether it's weakening or not is a source of some controversy and debate, but it's certainly a source of concern. And again, we're not quite sure what to do about this. In one of my other hats, I've got a consulting project with the Office of the Secretary of Defense. And we're dealing with this kind of phenomenon where how do you deter acts like the Crimea, like the Senkaku or Diu Islands, like cyber attacks, in an environment where the conventional or nuclear options don't look very credible, right? How do we respond to a country or a group that hacks into one of our companies, one of the firms, Sony Pictures or whatever? Do we threaten to launch a nuclear attack? It's not very credible. So these are ongoing problems, but they're also an indication of this evolving nature of the world. The world is getting more complicated and more difficult for policymakers, and that in itself makes it harder to maintain peace and stability. Okay. So I could have picked another list of three guys, but I pitched this presentation as about Vladimir Putin, and so I had to have him there. And these two others are so colorful and fun that I just put them in there. Right. So who's the worst guy here? Show of hands, who thinks Xi Jinping is the most dangerous person in the world right now? Okay. How about the young leader, North Korean dictator? A fair number. How about Putin? That's what I thought. Okay. So my pitch today, in fact, is that Putin is the guy that you should think is the biggest threat, but he's not. Okay? And it has to do with the nature of his objectives and the nature of the society that that supports him, that's his foundation of power. And I'll get back to that. So just think about that for a while. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about history, and then I'm going to talk about theory a little bit, and then we're going to go back to those three guys. Okay, so the Cold War... it's not popular today to think much about the Cold War, but I think it's a really important example because it creates the foundations for the world in which we live today. In the Second World War, the three major antagonist systems of the world became two antagonist systems. Those two systems then create another form of conflict in which they don't fight each other. Right? They're completely ready to do it. They're on a hair trigger. But in part, some argue because they're on a hair trigger, war doesn't happen, right? So this is a kind of peace in which war doesn't happen because everyone's so afraid of what war would look like when it does, okay? So the nuclear deterrent argument is that we got peace during the Cold War because everyone was afraid of what a hot war would produce, would do. And there's some validity to this, but it's surprisingly hard in systematic empirical evidence to show a very strong relationship between nuclear capabilities and a reduction in conflict behavior. In fact, in some cases, the relationship's the other way. The countries that have nuclear weapons tend to be more aggressive towards their neighbors and towards other countries, in part because they can. Right? If the U.S. sends forces to Iraq in the early aughts to invade, why doesn't Saddam threaten retaliation and send forces to the United States? Right? Now, granted, they won't be very capable forces because it's a long way away, and he's a much weaker political actor. But part of the reason is that the retaliation that any country would get from invading the United States would just be extraordinary. It would be unacceptable. Another example of this recently is Stuxnet. Stuxnet was a computer virus that was introduced into the Iranian nuclear centrifuge system. And what's striking about it is that, well, a couple of things. One, nobody claims credit. Okay. Two, everyone knows who really did it. Right. And three, the Iranians didn't do anything about it. Right. They didn't retaliate. And the reason they didn't retaliate is because of something called escalation dominance, that they basically understood, and the U.S. understood in potentially launching this cyber attack, that the retaliation, the reaction from the Iranians would be deterred by the next step in the process. So the Iranians react to Stuxnet with some kind of kinetic activity, some kind of violence. Well, they're just inviting the United States to do something even nastier, right? And so they lump it. They live in an environment that's not the one that they want because any action that they take is either going to be ineffective or it's going to make things worse. Okay. So the focus in the Cold War is on the nuclear deterrent. But I think one of the things that's clearly happening during the Cold War, which changes the world much more than nuclear weapons, is globalization. That as much as the United States sought to build a large military to discourage the Soviet Union from being aggressive towards the United States or its allies, the U.S. spent enormous resources and time trying to rejigger the world economy so that nobody would want to be part of the Soviet system. Right? And this becomes clearest in the early 1960s, where you have things like the building of the Berlin Wall, because basically Russia realizes that it has to keep its allies in through force because they don't want to be there voluntarily. Right? Individuals and ultimately entire countries want to defect to the West. So the part of the reason for this is that the West demonstrates that it can make you prosperous. It can make you comfortable. It can make you happy. And by being part of the global economy, and in fact, far more countries want to join the Western coalition because of economics than because of politics, right? There are many, many countries around the world that have problems with U.S. foreign policy, but they want to get rich. And so they join the system because the system works economically. It improves the lives of leaders and their followers. Okay. The other thing that's important here is that while the U.S. had enormous power, it didn't necessarily have enormous ambitions. There's this wonderful quote from George W. Bush in which he talks about how the United States has this tradition of going abroad, fighting wars, and then leaving. And he's got the empirics exactly right. One of the peculiarities of American empire is that we don't do empire. We go to foreign countries, we fight wars, we win most of the time, sometimes we don't, like recently, but then we leave. And it's clear from the outset that the objective of the United States is not to aggrandize its territorial possessions. Okay? Every civilization in the past that had the power, the kind of power to project its military forces abroad, was at some point or another intent on territorial aggrandizement. And the U.S. was for a very long time. It just stopped being that way. And I think that's the core of why we see a world in which there's relative peace. If the United States wanted to, it could become a larger territorial enterprise. Right? There's the old movie Canadian Bacon, in which the Canadians get together and decide they're going to invade the United States. And it's very funny because it's ironic. The power relationship is such that it would be the United States that would make that decision, whether it wanted to invade Canada, and it clearly doesn't want to. Okay, we're right on the border with Mexico. The United States expanded westward and westward and westward, and then it just stopped. Right? And today, if the United States wanted to increase the size of its territory, it could, much as Putin has done in the last few years. But the United States shows no interest in doing that. Instead, it's using military force abroad to make other countries behave themselves, to manipulate their domestic politics, but not to own the territory. And that's really important. So I'm going to describe that as a status quo orientation. Being very capable and having those limited objectives is really important in achieving peace. Okay. The quote that is most often, is often misunderstood, Teddy Roosevelt's idea of speaking softly and carrying a big stick. Okay. And if you can think of anyone in history who is least likely to say this, because, you know, Teddy Roosevelt was not known for speaking softly, right? But the idea here is that one of the ways in which you encourage stability and peace is by being very capable, but not exercising those capabilities for your own gain, right? Using them much more defensively, much more conservatively. So a crisis happens in U.S. history, And it happens in the early 1990s because we succeed. And the United States as a civilization, as a culture, is not prepared to succeed. When this happens, we don't know what to do. Right? And we have all these weird ideas coming out. You'll remember George Bush's 1,000 points of light. Right? And everyone said, what's the 1,000 points of light? And Washington kind of shrugged and said, I don't know. Right? And we didn't have an identity because our identity, our sense of purpose was all, for the entire 20th century, was oriented towards somebody else. Fighting communism, fighting Hitler, fighting the Japanese. And then suddenly, we have no one left meaningful to fight. There's almost a sigh of relief. I hate to say this, but this is, I'm not saying that this should have been the case. I'm saying that I believe it to be the case. After 9/11, because the entire society knew what it was about again, and we oriented towards the war on global terror with a sense of purpose. But it was a very strange thing to do, because while our adversaries had objectives that were incompatible with the United States and with the West, and while they clearly intended to pursue them, there was no plausible story one could make about how they would succeed. Okay? We moved from fighting the most powerful forces on Earth in history, Hitler and Stalin, to fighting guys that were hiding in caves in Tora Bora. Okay? Very, very, very marginal types. And it wasn't that we shouldn't have opposed them. It was that as an identity, as a purpose, as an objective for the nation, this was something that was of secondary or tertiary importance. The really important thing was maintaining maintaining the things that had worked so well to win the Cold War. And one of those in particular was maintaining prosperity globally. And we saw a few years ago what happened to that, right? We have this huge recession in part because the White House and leadership in Washington was focused on fighting two foreign wars that weren't ultimately very important for U.S. grand strategy, but were very attractive, were very attention-seeking, were something that we would see on the news every night, right? And what crept up under the radar screen was a huge financial disaster. Okay. So what do adversaries look like in this era when the U.S. is globally dominant? There are basically two types of adversaries out there. They're the dumb and desperate, and I'll put Al-Qaeda in that group, right? People who really don't have a reasonable chance, you know, of succeeding. And then we have adversaries that are smart enough to realize that their chance is not today, but it's tomorrow. And one of the things that sort of unites those three leaders, world leaders that I showed, is they're in this category of patient opponents. And they're the ones who have come to the fore today because they've had a decade and a half to prepare when we weren't paying attention. That's the threat. Okay. So, Putin is trying to change the world. He wants the world to look different from the way it looks and from the way that the U.S. advocates and from Western powers have maintained it. He's trying to reorient the political geography of his region in order to reassert Russian influence in the near abroad. He's trying to use strong-arm tactics with other states that are too far for him to interdict directly, but close enough that he can influence them or scare them, right? So the Russians have aggressively used energy policy, for example, with Europe to try to cow European powers and discourage them from creating a unified opposition to Russian influence in the near abroad. Putin's even made not-so-veiled nuclear threats about NATO intervention in Ukraine. It's clear that the Russians have other territory ambitions. There was an interesting claim just the other day that basically the Arctic is Russia, That's a debatable philosophical point, but as a point of international law, it's completely untrue. All right. Is this man a threat to world peace and security? Certainly. But how much of a threat? By the poll of hands that we had recently, he's the worst of those three actors. But I'm going to suggest, in fact, that he's a paper tiger. Okay. So we have to go back to what maintains peace and what undermines it to understand why it is that Putin, who looks pretty scary and acts pretty scary, is more, in a way, more like Al-Qaeda, a paper tiger, than he is like some of those other characters on that photo montage. All right, so we've got a world in which U.S. power is declining relative to other actors. That doesn't mean that we're declining in absolute terms. And I'm going to show you some pictures in a little bit that suggest we're not. But in relative terms, we're clearly under pressure. And you can go to Washington and talk to folks, and they're very nervous about this. Okay? The threats. Actors like Russia and China that kept their mouths shut, that played along for the last decade, they're not doing that anymore. They're confronting Western interests in places that are important to them. But it's important to recognize that the scariest stories are probably also not very realistic. That the one of the things that makes today different from the turn of the last century is the degree to which everyone in this process is exercising some degree of restraint, even the North Koreans. Okay, the North Koreans talk a good show, but oftentimes they don't actually carry out the threats that they make, and oftentimes they're willing to take a deal. Part of that talk is, in fact, to increase their leverage in negotiations. My colleague, Steph Haggard, can tell you a lot more about these things. Soon after the invasion of the Crimea by the Little Green Men from Russia, or wherever they were from, Putin starts to talk a very aggressive game about Eastern Ukraine, excuse me. And the Russian stock markets start doing something that no investor ever likes to see, right? They start trending down fast. The next morning, Putin calls a press conference, and he basically backtracks, right? He says, what I meant to say was that we're a strong country, and you should respect us, and we have interests, but we don't want a war with the West, okay? He was cowed not by Western sanctions, not by strong rhetoric from Washington, but by his own stock markets. His own investors' fear of loss of wealth was enough to get him to moderate his position. And while he continues to want to change the status quo, and while he continues to practice aggressive foreign policy, he does it at the lowest level he can in an attempt to minimize the damage that's being caused to his society. He's not succeeding, but he's clearly not taking the most direct path towards his foreign policy objectives. He's trying to get there by indirect measures in order to minimize the cost that he bears and his society bears. Okay. All right. So in order to understand why actors don't fight, it's useful to begin by thinking about what causes them to fight. And the old thinking is something like power. Right. You can read Hans Morgenthau or Thucydides, and they'll tell you that there's this power thing which no one has ever been able to define, and it's this stuff, it's sort of like money, but it's kind of different, and we use it to fight. Okay? But we also use it for lots of other things. And the problem with thinking about power as a cause of war is that it's also a cause of negotiation. And it's also a cause of just living with things the way they are, and it's also a cause of pretty much everything else we can think of. Power is a factor that conditions the distribution of prerogatives and benefits in the world. It doesn't necessarily tell us why we fight sometimes and other times just accept it. Right. So, diplomatic bargains can preempt conflict, and most of the time, this is what happens. When the North Koreans make threats in the world, usually those threats aren't acted out. Usually what happens is there's some kind of diplomatic engagement, some kind of low-key, behind-the-scenes contact that results in a compromise, some kind of settling of tensions. The new thinking about the causes of war are that they have to do with our inability to negotiate. That war is basically a failure of bargaining. And the reason that that failure of bargaining occurs is that you and I can't agree on what war will produce. Okay? You go to buy a new car. And you go to the car dealership, and you know that they're interested in selling that car at the highest price that they can. By the way, oftentimes when people go into bargaining environments, the salesperson's first question is, what's your budget? Right? And this is very conventional. Everyone thinks this is reasonable. But in bargaining terms, this is the worst possible thing for you to answer because you're essentially saying, here's how much I can afford. Please sell me the least valuable thing on the lot. Okay? The right response for you, usually, would be to say, well, how much of a car are you willing to give me? Right? I'm interested in getting the most vehicle for a set price. Now, I don't know if that's my budget constraint or not, but I'm going to pretend it is for right now. You're interested in selling me the lease vehicle for the set price. When that succeeds is when you are able to negotiate with the salesperson to a common price. And when that fails is when you're not. And one of the main things that determines whether you succeed or fail in that process is discovery. What you learn through the negotiation process that allows you to identify what they're willing to do, what's their reservation price, what they're willing to sell this for, and what they're not willing to sell this for. In international negotiations, we have the same basic problem. Countries want different things, and they have to compromise to live together. And they sometimes succeed at this, and they sometimes fail. And a big determinant of the failure is when they want different things and they can't figure out how much they're willing to pay to get what they want. Okay? So the contemporary thinking about the causes of war is that what leads the parties to fight is not that they're able to fight, but because they can't work out a deal. And the reason they can't work out a deal is that they have different expectations about what the war itself will produce. If you think you're going to win the next war, and I think I'm going to win the next war, we've got a problem. So I'm going to move along here a little bit to the causes of peace. And thankfully, the causes of peace are much simpler in many ways than the causes of war, because the causes of war are multifaceted. You have to have these different components all working together for war to happen. You can take out any one of these, and you get peace. One of my advisor's favorite examples was the Austria-Australia problem. I sometimes think of this as Bhutan and Rwanda, right? Probably not going to fight each other. Doesn't matter if they disagree about stuff. They're just too weak, okay? So the lack of capabilities itself is a determinant of peace. The lack of differences of objectives, if you have compatible objectives, that's a determinant of peace. Right? And the availability of alternative mechanisms to resolve your differences is another mechanism for peace. Okay? So you don't need to believe that people are good. You don't need to believe that or hope that people will change their nature. You don't need to expect that love will pervade and will become more understanding of each other. All you have to believe is that actors are either not capable of projecting and using force against each other, or they're not interested in doing it, or that there are mechanisms that will allow them to negotiate more effectively. All right. So this layered notion of the causes of war means that we have multiple vectors or avenues through which we can get at the absence of war. And the first is negative peace, and this is basically deterrence. Okay? I'm not going to attack you because I realize that fighting is very costly or that I'm unlikely to succeed if I do. That's deterrence. The risk in deterrence, however, is that if one country has a lot of capabilities to defend itself, it's very, very, very tempting for it to convert those capabilities not into deterrent, but into compellence. Okay? I like to tell the story about how the Roman Empire got built. And it's basically every step of the way the Romans were protecting themselves. They just kept redefining who Rome was. Okay? Three Carthaginian wars. In each case, Carthage is fighting at a heavier disadvantage than it was before, closer to its territory and farther from Rome, because Rome won the last war and added new territory to Rome. So now it's defending Sicily and calling it Rome when before it was defending the mainland of Italy. Okay? If you use increased capabilities to grab more of the world's resources, space, or population, you're a threat to others. This is what Putin's doing right now. If you use your increased capabilities not to do that, then you're not a threat. And one of the great innovations of U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War was this recognition that we didn't have to grab a bunch of stuff to be safe. What we had to do is get lots of other countries to feel that they were safe and they were prosperous in order to be safe. And we succeeded. Okay. Positive peace is the absence of interest in using force in the first place. Now, you can still have the ability to use it, but you're not interested in using force. And if you can convey to others that you have positive peace, that you're not interested in aggression, then they're very likely to be less interested in being aggressive towards you. Okay? So during the Cold War, the U.S. had a big stick, nuclear weapons. It had enormous conventional capabilities, and it went around the world and said, get rich, we'll mostly leave you alone, we don't want your territory, once in a while we'll ask you to vote our way in the UN, but we'll usually lose that anyway, but mostly what we want you to do is to work with us to oppose this thing that we both oppose. Okay. So, in the process of trying to recruit members for the coalition to oppose our enemies, we create friends through globalization. We make the rest of the world, or increasing portions of the world, rich. And when they're rich, they'd much rather continue to be rich than they would squabble over little pieces of territory. Now, there's recidivism on occasion. I think this is one of the things that really worries me in Asia, that these countries are arguing over useless little lumps of sand in the ocean. But for the most part, countries catch on and they stop worrying about the things that were important to them in the past because they have new priorities. After 800 years of fighting over Alsace-Lorraine, France and Germany say, you know, so what? We'll buy the coal and white wine, and we'll share it, right? Cyprus. Cyprus is divided by the Civil War in 1974, and for a generation and a half, it's just bitter hostility between two sides. And then a new generation is born, and these folks care more about getting rich and having a nice apartment than they do about grandma's farm. And Cyprus is given a deal. The Greek population is basically told, you can join the UN, the EU, but you have to put this this old fight in the past. And because of the generational change and because of the apparent opportunity for acquiring wealth that is not based on territory, this is a wake-up call for the Cypriots, the Greek Cypriots, and they vote overwhelmingly in favor of joining the EU. In Iraq, the opposite happens. After the U.S. invasion, the critical moment is the bombing of the Samarra Mosque. It becomes a sectarian fight, and in order to win the sectarian fight, groups start reasserting the old traditional logic of tribalism and territory. Right? So if you're a professional, you're a threat to this order. If you're in an economy that doesn't care about land, you're a threat to this order. And those folks become the targets on both sides of the tribal leadership, of the sectarian leadership, right? And we return Iraq which was beginning to move out of a traditional society, we return it to a very traditional setting. So what I want to look for, what I want to see, is a kind of mechanism that generates peace from, not from altruism, but from selfishness, because I think it's the most durable and stable thing. If you want to be peaceful because it's good for you, instead of wanting to be peaceful because it's good for somebody else, the chances that you'll maintain it, even when you have questions in your head about whether others will do this, are higher. Selfishness is not the best human motive, but we're pretty sure it's around. And it's a pretty useful motive to exploit, if you can, for good purposes, right? Again, this idea of Teddy Roosevelt talks about speaking softly and carrying a big stick, but the question is, why would he think that? Why would he feel that way? At the turn of the last century, the United States is moving into an era when it's the dominant economic power in the world. It's the biggest, world's largest economy. It's becoming a society in which the aspirations and goals of the citizens and of the leadership are maximized by getting rich, not by getting more territory. It has started to move away from a traditional model in which territory was the point of the entire society. If you look at the United States from its founding until the late 19th century, it's a continuous process of territorial aggrandizement. And then it just quits. It stops this process. And I think it stops this because it becomes economically developed and it doesn't care about having more territory anymore. It cares a lot about having more wealth. And the way to get more wealth is to trade with other countries, engage with them economically, and so on. Okay. I have to move on a little bit. So one of the things that's happening today is there's a lot of hardware being built. There's a lot of weapons being produced. And this is a little bit scary. It could potentially be okay. As long as this is a very conservative effort, if everybody's building weapons and speaking softly, we're okay. There's some question in my mind about whether that's happening. And the pivotal actor here is not Russia. It's China. So move through this. I'm happy to share these slides. There's a lot more evidence of these processes that I'm talking about, and a little more theory that we won't cover here today. There's a slightly funny story about Norman Angel. He tells about Anlaf the Viking, who's a Danish warlord, and invades the British Midlands the east coast of Essex in the 10th century, and carries off all the booty of his raid. And Angel asks at the turn of the 20th century why the British Royal Navy, which is the largest navy in the world, why don't they do payback? Why don't they go to Copenhagen and pile these battle wagons high with paper pulp and butter and things like this and bring them back to England? And the basic explanation is that this is hugely, hugely inefficient. You can buy the stuff on the world market much more cheaply than you can steal it, right? And the second problem is you're going to make enemies of all the people in the process, the peaceful process, who are profiting from that trade. If you come back with all this stuff, you're going to crater the market for these commodities, the prices go down, and the shippers and producers and speculators are all going to lose a fortune. So they're going to hate you, right? So basically, in the modern world, stealing stuff is not efficient. It's much cheaper to buy it. This is why, by the way, that we buy our oil instead of stealing it. We could go conquer places with lots of oil and force them to give the oil to us for free, but the cost of doing it would be much higher than simply paying them for it. Bank robbers. Almost no bank robbers rob everything they use, right? They rob a bank, they take the money, and then they go to a store to buy stuff with cash, just like you and I. It's kind of a silly thing to do in some sense, but it's efficient because stealing toilet paper from the grocery store is a waste of time when you've just robbed a bank. You got a lot of cash, right? All right. So the critical thing that I want to point out is that wealth itself is a deterrent to war. And the reason it's a deterrent to war is it makes people rich and makes them unwilling to engage in a laborious and risky activity in order to plunder. We don't see rich countries plundering each other. Donald Trump is not on a street corner with a pistol mugging people because it's not worth his time. Right? Rich, prosperous societies spend most of their time thinking about ways to get richer and more prosperous, which has to do with peaceful activities, not with warfare. So, again, there's a lot of evidence here that I'm skimming through. But what's really remarkable is the degree to which we can document a lot of these things today. It's not just a reasonable idea. It's that we're showing these trends empirically. Okay. So back to these three guys, and I think this will be my closing comment. When I asked you in the audience who was the biggest threat, I think we got sort of, in order of appearance here. The scariest guy was Putin, and I have no qualms about, if I had to pick a roommate in college, it would not necessarily be the second two guys, all right? But in terms of the actor that's most likely to change the world for the worse, it's Xi Jinping, because he's sitting on a society that's enormously powerful, that has a huge economy, that's diversified. Deng Xiaoping got the economics right. Okay, Gorbachev, for all our appreciation for him, got it wrong, and plunged his country into poverty. Now the Russians are going back to poverty. They had a spell of prosperity, but they lost it because they're a mono economy. They're an Arab chinkdom with bad weather, right? They're basically, in the early 1990s, Russia had some of the best human capital in the world, and it threw it under a bus because it couldn't control it politically, and decided that they'd rather be poorer and better politically controlled than richer and have to deal with the fact that the population could do what it wanted. So while Putin is probably one of the most threatening guys today, and the young leader is certainly pretty scary, it's Xi Jinping's opportunity to decide whether the world's going to look like it has in the past, with lots of prosperity and peace, or whether we're going to go into another era that's more like the Cold War. And I will leave it at that. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.